Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Arapaho County News, read by Tim Elliott. This is being recorded on April 27th, 2024. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Former sheriff's deputy convicted of misdemeanor in shooting death of Christian Glass, by the Sentinel and by the Associated Press. Paramedic who injected Elijah McClain with ketamine before his death gets 14 months in jail and probation, by the Sentinel and Colleen Slevin, Associated Press. Plans to change Inglewood's community policy stalls, by Elizabeth Slay. A day of service. Columbine teacher assists with reshaping narrative, also by Elizabeth Slay. Jane Withers, Denver's famed Hubcap Annie, dies in Littleton, by Ellis Arnold. Highlands Ranch residents say safety is a big concern amid intersection reconstruction, by Haley Lenny. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Former sheriff's deputy convicted of misdemeanor in shooting death of Christian Glass. The jury found Deputy Buen guilty of reckless endangerment, and it is one step closer to getting justice for Christian. Deputy Buen will reface a jury of his peers. A former Colorado sheriff's deputy was convicted of a misdemeanor on Friday in the shooting death of a 22-year-old man in distress who had called 911 for help after his car got stuck in a small mountain community. Andrew Buen was also charged with second-degree murder and official misconduct in the 2022 death of Christian Glass, which drew national attention and prompted calls for police reform focused on crisis intervention. But jurors could not reach a verdict on those charges and only found him guilty of reckless endangerment, which is typically punished by a maximum 4 months in jail, the Denver Post reported. A second-degree murder conviction would have carried a sentence of years in prison. Prosecutors alleged that Buen needlessly escalated a standoff with Glass, who exhibited signs of a mental health crisis. But the defense said Buen shot Glass to protect a fellow officer, which made the shooting legally justified. A second officer indicted in Glass' death previously pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor. Six other officers have been charged with failing to intervene. District Attorney Heidi McCollum still has the option of pursuing the charges against Buen for murder and official misconduct. She said Friday she expects to make a decision in the next couple of weeks. An attorney for the Glass family said the family would like the prosecution to continue. The jury found Deputy Buen's conduct to be criminal, Siddhartha Rathid said. The jury found Deputy Buen guilty of reckless endangerment, and it is one step closer to getting justice for Christian. Deputy Buen will reface a jury of his peers. Glass called for help after his SUV became stuck on a dirt road in Silver Plum. He told a dispatcher he was being followed and made other statements suggesting he was paranoid, hallucinating or delusional, and experiencing a mental health crisis, according to Buen's indictment. When Buen and other officers arrived, Glass refused to get out of his vehicle. Officers' body camera footage showed Glass making heart shapes with his hands to the officers and praying, "Dear Lord, please don't let them break the window." In closing arguments on Wednesday, prosecutors said Buen decided from the start that Glass needed to get out of the vehicle and shouted commands at him 46 times over about 10 minutes. The prosecution contends Buen did not have any legal justification to force Glass out, not even if it was a suspected case of driving under the influence. They fired beanbag rounds and shocked him with a taser, but those attempts failed to make Glass exit. He then took a knife he had offered to surrender at the beginning of the encounter and flung it out a rear window, which was broken by a beanbag, toward another officer, Randy Williams, according to the indictment. At that point, Buin fired 5 times at Glass. Glass just reacted after being treated like an animal in a cage being poked and prodded, and the knife never touched Williams, District Attorney Heidi McCollum told jurors in closing arguments in Idaho Springs. Defense lawyer Carrie Slinkard faulted prosecutors for not looking into whether Glass had behavioral or physiological issues that could explain his behavior, whether drugs had played a role, or whether both factors could have contributed. Glass' mother, Sally Glass, has previously said her son has depression and had recently been diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. She said he was having a mental health episode during his interaction with the police. Chief Deputy District Attorney Stephen Potts, who described Glass as a terrified boy, said it did not matter what prompted the crisis. He was in a crisis of some kind, he said. Is this how we expect police in crisis to be treated? Paramedic who injected Elijah McClain with ketamine before his death gets 14 months in jail and probation. Eternal shame on all of you, Shanine McClain said. A former paramedic who injected Elijah McClain with a powerful sedative avoided prison Friday and was sentenced to 14 months in jail. With work release and probation in the killing of the black man that helped fuel the 2020 racial injustice protests. Jeremy Cooper had faced up to 3 years in prison after being found guilty in a jury trial last year of criminally negligent homicide. He administered a dose of ketamine to McClain, 23, who had been forcibly restrained after police stopped him as the massage therapist was walking home in Aurora in 2019. The sentencing caps a series of trials that stretched over 7 months and resulted in the convictions of a police officer and 2 paramedics. Criminal charges against paramedics and emergency medical technicians involved in police custody cases are rare. Cooper, who was fired after his conviction, was sentenced to 4 years of probation, including 4 months in jail, under a program that will allow him to leave for work and return to jail at night and on weekends, said Lawrence Pacheco with the Colorado Attorney General's office. The other paramedic involved in McClain's death received a more severe punishment after being convicted on an additional charge of felony assault. Judge Mark Warner said evidence showed Cooper did not purposely give McClain a ketamine overdose, rejecting claims by prosecutors that the paramedic had acted with indifference. McClain's mother told the judge prior to Friday's sentencing that she blamed McClain's death on everyone who was present that night, not just those who were convicted. Eternal shame on all of you, Shanine McClain said. She said Cooper did nothing to help her son after he'd been restrained by police. Didn't check his pulse, didn't check his breathing, and didn't ask him how he was doing before injecting him with an overdose of ketamine. Close to tears, McClain ended by raising her right fist in the air and saying loudly, "From my heart to my hands, long live Elijah McClain, always and forever." She later told reporters that she wasn't expecting much from the trials and wasn't surprised Cooper avoided prison time. "We won, Elijah won," she said. Experts say the convictions would have been unheard of before 2020, when George Floyd's murder sparked a nationwide reckoning over racist policing and deaths in police custody. At least 94 people died after they were given sedatives and restrained by police from 2012 through 2021, according to the findings by the Associated Press in collaboration with Frontline, PBS, and the Howard Centers for Investigative Journalism. McClain's name became a rallying cry in protest over racial injustice in policing that swept the U.S. in 2020. Without the reckoning over criminal justice and how people of color suffer at much higher rates from police use of force and violence, it's very unlikely that anything would have come of this, that there would have been any charges, let alone convictions, said David Harris, a University of Pittsburgh law professor and expert on racial profiling. Harris added that jurors are often reluctant to second-guess the actions of police and other first responders. "It's still very hard to convict," he said. Cooper said during the hearing that he was sorry he couldn't save McLean. "I want you to know that I would give anything to have a different outcome, Elijah," Cooper said as if he were talking to McLean. "I never, ever meant for anyone to hurt you." He added that he wished he knew more at that time, implying that he could have used that knowledge to help McLean. Shanine McLean walked out of the courtroom as Cooper was speaking, but later returned. Prosecutor Jason Slothuber had asked the judge to incarcerate Cooper and argued that the paramedic was singularly most responsible for McLean's death because Cooper gave him a massive dose of ketamine. Cooper's attorney and wife and fellow firefighters urged the judge to show leniency. They described him saving people from fires, jumping into floodwaters to help an older woman, and using CPR to try to save a child who died in a fire. Cooper was not taken into custody after the hearing. He declined to comment as he walked out of the courthouse with his wife and supporters. Judge Warner previously sentenced ex-paramedic Peter Sisinchiek in March to 5 years in prison. He faced the most serious of the charges in the case. It was the shortest sentence allowed under the law. Warner sentenced Officer Randy Rodima to 14 months in jail with work release for criminally negligent homicide and misdemeanor assault. Prosecutors initially declined to pursue charges related to McLean's death when an autopsy did not determine how he died. Democratic Governor Jared Polis ordered the investigation reopened in 2020. The second autopsy said McLean died because he was injected with ketamine after being forcibly restrained. Since the killings of Floyd, McLean and others put a spotlight on police custody deaths. Many departments, paramedic units, and those that train them have re-examined how they treat suspects. Medical experts said by the time he received the sedative, McLean already was in a weakened state from forcible restraint, and that rendered him temporarily unconscious. McLean was not armed nor accused of breaking any laws. He went into cardiac arrest on the way to the hospital and died 3 days later. The Colorado Health Department has since told paramedics not to give ketamine to people suspected of having excited delirium, described in a since-withdrawn emergency physician's report as manifesting symptoms including increased strength. A doctor's group has called it an unscientific definition rooted in racism. The protests over McLean and Floyd also ushered in a wave of state legislation to curb the use of neck holds. At least 27 states, including Colorado, have passed some limit on the practices. Only two had bans in place before Floyd was killed. Shanine McLean said outside the courthouse Friday that the only closure she got was that the trials and sentencings were over. "It doesn't matter what anybody else does to wipe the blood off my son off their hands," she said. "It's already there." Aurora police seek public's help identifying suspected middle school vandals. Photos provided by the police department show multiple broken windows and broken trophy cases. By Kristen O., Sentinel, Colorado. Aurora police are looking for the public's help identifying two males accused of breaking into and causing significant damages to Aurora West Preparatory Academy last Monday night. At about 11:10 p.m. on Monday night, based on video surveillance, two males broke into the school, according to an APD press statement Wednesday morning. APD spokesperson Joe Moylan previously said the officers responded to a report of a burglary and vandalism at 5 a.m. Due to the amount of damages and because police need to investigate, the school was closed Tuesday. Classes resumed Wednesday. Photos provided by the police department show multiple broken windows and broken trophy cases, with shards of glass littering the hallways. In one photograph, a TV in a classroom was broken. The police department also shared photos of the two males. Both were wearing black T-shirts and black shoes. One male wore jeans and wore dark sunglasses. The other wore black pants, black hat, and a black crossbody bag. No tattoos or piercings are visible in the photograph provided by the police department. More than academics, Aurora Community Schools exemplify the growing concept. If we empower our parents, this helps our kids, Ray said. They teach me how to raise my voice, how to speak up. By Yesenia Robles, Chalkbeak, Colorado. When Bijnu Ray's children started school at Aurora's Crawford Elementary 5 years ago, she initially felt lost. She wasn't very social, and she struggled to help her children, she says. But thanks to Crawford's community school model, she's been getting more involved learning English, and now feels confident enough she's helping come up with a plan for empowering other immigrant parents. Crawford Elementary is one of six schools in Aurora that are part of the Action Zone, a group of schools near Denver's border that have high levels of poverty and large numbers of language learners. The district grouped the schools years ago as part of a plan to better support the schools with similar needs. At Crawford, some of the work has gone on for almost 10 years, but evolved as the zone schools committed to a community schools model in the past 5 years. The approach focuses on using community partners to address whole family needs, with the end goal of ensuring that children have fewer social and emotional barriers to learning. In Colorado, nonprofit organizations and the state education department are increasing their focus on how they support schools that want to use the community schools model. Some of these leaders say they see an untapped potential for improving communities. At Crawford, 97% of the school's 540 students qualify for subsidized meals, a measure of poverty, and students come from 40 different countries speaking about 25 different languages. Through the community schools model, Crawford works with organizations to test students' eyesight at school, helps parents learn how they can continue lessons at home, and brings families together to share about their various cultures. Ray also has taken advantage of English classes, health classes, and parent leadership classes. Parents are involved in big school decisions. For instance, parents helped pick the year's new principal by participating in interviews and hosting a forum where parents could ask questions of the applicants and fill out scorecards. If we empower our parents, this helps our kids, Ray said. They teach me how to raise my voice, how to speak up. Supporting the model takes resources. Colorado Department of Education officials recently visited Crawford and Boston K-8, two of Aurora's zone schools, as part of the state's work to better understand how the community schools model is implemented and what resources can be shared with other schools looking to try the same model. State lawmakers in 2022 added adopting the model to the menu of improvement options for schools on the state's watch list for low performance. The State Education Department had some support for the model spread across various departments, but now is creating a team focused on supporting the community schools model. We're happy to connect schools with resources, said Dana Scott, director of the Office of Student Supports for the State Department of Education. We want to be a place where we can really create some good connections for them so schools don't have to start from scratch. The state doesn't track how many districts are using the model, but nationwide, some experts believe the model has had growing interest, and more so since the start of the pandemic. Even as schools shut down, they served as hubs for various help to families in the community, providing meals, internet, COVID tests, shots, and more. Katie Wilberding Cross, Senior Director for Youth Initiatives and Education for Mile High United Way, helps lead a coalition of organizations that want to support community schools. The coalition just started meeting in the fall. She says the idea behind community schools is that students have needs that can be a barrier to learning, but schools should be accepted to be everything for everybody. There are partners that provide these different needs, Wilberding Cross said. United Ways are uniquely positioned to convene folks, to bring these various organizations and sectors together. She said part of the work is getting more districts to learn about the model. It's hard to say how much interest is in Colorado. What I keep hearing is there's a lot of percolating interest, but it's something that hasn't been fully tapped into, Wilberding Cross said. In the metro area, Adams 14 has had national support in trying to start using the model at Central Elementary, one of the district's lowest performing schools, which is under a state-ordered improvement plan of its own. The hope is that the model will eventually help improve student achievement. The Harrison School District of Colorado Springs also uses the model at one of its schools, and Pueblo 60 uses it at two of its schools. Many more schools are likely doing much of the same work community schools focus on, such as starting a food pantry for families or partnering with community organizations to provide another service for students or families. But they don't have the community schools label or a plan with the intentionality that the model would provide. Having a community schools coordinator on staff ensures that the partnerships belong to the schools and not an individual teacher or principal who might leave. That those partnerships are responsive to the needs in the community and that they are providing something for the families. With those elements in place, the work is more likely to be successful and to continue beyond just a year or two, experts said. Schools trying to use the community schools approach generally hire a community schools coordinator. At Crawford, Maggie Lotzenheiser Page, the community schools coordinator, helps plan and run the various programs offered for the school's needs, which are different than the programs offered at the next school using the model. Then it's not burdening or putting more weight on educators, said Krista Rowland, Western Regional Deputy Director for the Coalition for Community Schools from the Institute for Educational Leadership, a national nonprofit group based in Washington, D.C. Rather, it should lift it. The community school coordinator is key, leaders agree. The person should have some decision-making authority at the school level to help drive the work. Wilberding Cross said, there should be district buy-in, and the plans need to be designed with the community, evaluating needs and existing assets, experts said. If schools are following Colorado's definition of community schools as laid out in Colorado statute, then they have to assess the community's needs every year. Hiring that community school coordinator to implement this model does require an investment. Experts say research has shown the investment can pay off with more resources coming to the school and improved measures of attendance, parent engagement, and eventually other student outcomes. Aurora has made some of that investment. The community school coordinators, one at each of the school zones, are district funded. The district is working to find permanent funding for some of the other positions, including community health coordinators and family liaisons for special populations that speak different languages. The model has helped improve family and community engagement and enable parents, such as Ray, to feel empowered to help the children's learning. But, based on state ratings, the schools in the zone haven't seen much improvement in students' academic achievement. Aurora Central High School, the district's longest struggling school, is part of the zone and has continued to have low state ratings. Leaders celebrate other measures of community school success. Crawford principal Aubrey Duncan, who is new this year, said most school leaders want their schools to be hubs for the community. But this truly is a hub, Duncan said, noting that the community school model allows the school to support parents and help them navigate potential barriers, so students come to school more regularly and ready to learn. At Crawford, 50 parents, including Ray, regularly attend leadership meetings. The zone's two food clinics, which provide food and connect parents to other resources, host regular events to give out local food. Last school year, they served more than 4,700 individuals in the events. Within the district, leaders say students whose families are engaged are showing better outcomes than those who aren't. And across the zone, definitely more than half of our families are attending and participating in events on a regular basis, said Elizabeth Lewis, the district's community schools impact manager. At Crawford, which recently received a large number of new migrant students, parent leaders want to pass on what they've learned to help the new migrant parents be involved for their children, Ray said. She's also hoping to raise another issue beyond her school, pedestrian safety. She said families who walk to the school want a new stop sign at one of the bus intersections. Parents years ago successfully lobbied the city to install one outside the school, but now there's a need for another, she said. Experts say it's that kind of drive by parents that really creates sustainability and a model that is responsive to the evolving needs of the community. Plan to change Inglewood's comment policy stalls. A proposal to place tighter restrictions on public comment at Inglewood City Council meeting stalled following a lively debate between council members. The council did not move forward with several proposed changes to the city's public comment practices when the move failed on a 3-3 vote at the April 15th council meeting, short of the majority vote the measure would have required. District 4 council member Steve Ward was absent. At the meeting, District 1 council member and Mayor Othniel Sierra, District 3 council member and Mayor Pro Tem Joe Anderson, and District 2 council member Chelsea Noonenkamp voted in favor of the proposal with some amendments. At-large council members Tana Prang, Rita Russell, and Kim Wright voted against the proposal, citing concerns for transparency and community involvement. The seven of us sit up here and talk all the time. We haven't really put word out inviting people to come, Russell said of the proposal. Why are they? Where do they stand on this? It's not really open and transparent. Those in favor of the changes disagreed with Russell, mentioning the council has talked about these changes since October of last year. Wright and Prang, who were elected last year and took office in December, were not part of those initial conversations, and both feel more time is needed to research, discuss, and vote on these items with a full body. Any further consideration of the proposal will be delayed by City Attorney Tamara Niles to do further research. No fixed date for the item to reappear on the agenda has been set, but the council may discuss and vote again when all members are present. Proposed changes, as listed in meeting materials, include the following. Eliminating online public comment. Limiting public comment to 3 minutes per speaker, about 60 minutes total. Starting the public comment clock when the mayor calls the speaker's name, unless the person requires additional time to reach the podium due to impaired mobility. This shifted towards starting the clock when the speaker starts to talk. Prioritizing speakers based on order of sign-up, with the provision that if they spoke in the last 90 days, they are placed at the bottom of the list. Providing AV materials to city staff by Wednesday at 5 p.m. prior to meetings. This shifted toward an outright ban on AV materials. Clarifying that no person may disrupt a meeting in any way, not just through booing, clapping, yelling, or speaking. Requiring a speaker to give a name and location, and clarifying that no one who refused to provide this information would be allowed to speak. Clarifying that only written materials may be provided to council by a speaker. Limiting the use of cameras to an alcove at the back of the council chambers, with an exception for camera use immediately after recognition ceremonies. Sierra said these proposed changes, many of which were discussed in a March 11 study session were proposed to bring the city's public comments policies in line with what other cities in the metro area and the states are doing. Inglewood currently has some of the more lenient rules around public comment, and we want to still continue to provide that forum for our constituents and members of the public while making sure we're still able to get to the business of the city in a timely fashion during council meeting evenings, Sierra said. Inglewood resident Jane Waypert, who spoke during unscheduled public comment at the April 15th meeting, implored the council to refrain from making these changes to the public comment process. "We need to be heard," Waypert said. "That's our right as a citizen. We don't have to follow all the other cities' guidelines. We are a standalone city." Others who spoke during public comment on April 15th also felt some changes, such as removing online comments and requiring speakers to give their names and address or cross streets, were exclusionary and could potentially impact their safety. Prang said she understands these concerns and feels that there needs to be more information about best practices, particularly around the removal of online public comment. Anderson said his main concern regarding online public comment was the possibility of hate speech and how the council would need to respond. The Castle Rock Town Council dealt with this issue and removed the option for remote public comment in February, citing anonymous anti-Semitic attacks on public meetings in Wheat Ridge and Lakewood through online comments. On April 8th, the Inglewood City Council did approve on first reading changes to the public comment ordinance to reflect the council's current practices. Sierra said those amendments will go into effect 30 days from publication after passing the second reading. Amendments approved on April 8th to reflect current practice included eliminating restrictions on who may provide written or spoken public comment so that it can be provided by any person rather than only taxpayers, residents, or interested parties. Allowing preference to be given to speakers in the order they sign up and to speakers who haven't addressed the council in 90 days. Allowing the council to limit the length of public comment. Eliminating content regulation by removing a requirement that public comment cannot be directed to a specific council member, and removing the prohibition on asking a council member a question. A day of service. Columbine teacher assists with reshaping narrative. Every day, Jeffrey Garkow frequents the halls of his alma mater. Garkow graduated from Columbine High School in 2006 and now works there as a social studies teacher. He is one of the first people to help reshape how the school honors the 13 lives taken on April 20, 1999. Prior to 2017, the school wouldn't hold classes on April 20th. My experience with April 20th on the professional side of things was that it was just a day off, Garkow said. I think that was hard for a lot of people, especially for the staff who were here on April 20th, 1999. So, in 2016, Garkow said he and other Columbine educators decided to reimagine the day off and launched Day of Service. This, I think, is kind of giving us the chance to control the narrative a little more than what Columbine has been through and what we are now, he said. The first Day of Service was held in 2017. Garkow said about 400 students volunteered to participate. Last year, around 1,500 of the school's 1,700 students participated in the event. Students, alumni, staff, and community members participate in various projects on the Day of Service, including volunteering at nursing homes, spending time at animal shelters, cleaning up parks, working with younger students in the district, and cleaning up the campus. In 2019, Governor Jared Polis signed a proclamation declaring that Colorado will observe a Day of Service and recommitment on April 20th each year. Over the years, more alumni have gotten involved with the day, and even planned their own versions of the event at other schools or their places of employment. Frank DeAngelis, former Columbine principal, said people have participated in the Day of Service from beyond the state, even as far away as Tanzania. "It's stuff like that I think is so important," he said, "because here's the thing. There are kids now that weren't even born, but there are certain messages, kindness, saying thank you. How do we make the world a better place?" Mandy Cook, a Columbine High School employee and survivor of the shooting, said the Day of Service reflects the school's current attitude of moving forward with hope. "We have turned that day into something so positive," she said, "and that is what I am most proud of, is making sure that our current students know how to be better humans in the world, instead of this awful, tragic thing that happened to us." For Garkow, the best aspect of Day of Service is the reactions from students who he says have loved participating in the celebration and carry that impact long after they graduate or leave. "It's just a really cool thing to hear students talk about that and how much of an impact that made on them and how much they continue to want to do that now," Garkow said. Garkow was in fifth grade at Governor's Ranch Elementary School on April 20, 1999. All he really remembers is learning the impact that day had on the community. Sometimes students ask him about the shooting, and Garkow said he is as open as possible with them and does his best to answer their questions. "There is so much misinformation online and on social media, or on Reddit, or in news articles about our school and the culture of our school that I think students pick up on," Garkow said. Garkow feels protective of his students. He feels they should not have to answer to people who are curious about the school. "What responsibility do our kids have to own that story when they weren't even alive during it?" Garkow said. "I think a lot of our kids have a different take on it now because they didn't experience any of it." As a student himself, Garkow didn't fully comprehend what had happened, but did witness how tight-knit the community became. "I came into the school already as a kid with a lot of pride in seeing what the community did after that, and seeing how the community responded," Garkow said. He said DeAngelis became the center of that community in many ways. "I think so much of why we are the community we are today is because of Frank," Garkow said. "That guy absolutely gave up everything for himself to take care of the community and made sure every kid felt valued and welcomed." Garkow said DeAngelis later hired him to teach at the school. He worked with DeAngelis for a few years before DeAngelis retired. "I absolutely love being in the school," Garkow said. "There's 20-plus alumni who I think work in the building, and I think that speaks a lot to the strength of the community and how much the school means to people." Garkow said the community of the school feels almost like a family. "I think it's rare to work in a place where so many of the people you were with are just dear friends," Garkow said. "It's pretty rare that I feel like I'm coming here just to work." Garkow works with a lot of his own former teachers. "They are mentors and friends and people who I hope I can model myself after as an educator, just because they meant so much to me when I was a student here," Garkow said. Garkow said he hopes more stories about where the school is now are told rather than only reflecting on the past. "There is so much tragedy, but there have also been so many beautiful moments that have come out since, that I think it gives a much better picture of who we are now and where we are as a school," Garkow said. A Passion for a Forgotten Plot by Belin Ward. Bill Knox, 93, grew up in Volmar neighborhood in Weld County, just northwest of Fort Lupton. Knox said his parents had a ranch there, and he went to school with kids who lived in Volmar and its surrounding areas. They all went to the little Volmar schoolhouse, which has since been converted into a home, he said. One thing that always caught his eye was the little cemetery there. the St. Francis Volmar Cemetery. Still living in the area, Knox still thinks about it and visits it often. His goal now, before he passes, is to help save and preserve this historic cemetery. Every time I'd go by it, it bothered me that most of these tombstones are covered with sand up to 3 feet deep, Knox said. I would like to clean that somehow up before I pass away. The cemetery is an acre and a quarter with about 35 to 40 people buried there. He said he started to look in on the cemetery 5 years ago, but started to research it 2 years ago. It's set between Weld County Roads 21 and 23 west of Fort Lupton. Information about the plot is hard to come by, he said. I looked up the deed at the Weld County Assessor's Office. The last time it was deeded was in 1926, and the St. Francis Volmar Association ran it. I traced it back. It may have been null and void in the 1940s, Knox said. Knox has since taken over the deed and the association name at the cemetery. He's now looking for people who grew up in the neighborhood, or the descendants of those that did. He asks that anyone who knows about the cemetery and who might have relatives buried, or simply someone who has the resources to help him preserve it, to call at 970-372-0759. It's just a shame that the cemetery is neglected, Knox said. Long neglected. It's always been a tough plot, he said. He remembers growing up during the Depression. During the Depression, the sandstorms practically covered the old cemetery there, Knox said. Knox said the cemetery contains 100% Spanish buried plots, and it should be dedicated to uncovering and preserving that history. It was all the Spanish people that lived in Volmar, Knox said. The people buried there, he figures, are the ones who helped the community grow by laboring in the sugar beet factory, cleaning beets. The area was a huge supplier to Great Western Sugar's factory in Brighton, and although the factory remained in operation until 1977, he thinks Volmar's association ended in the late 1940s. Little official history. Knox said he called many people, including Weld County Genealogy, but has yet to learn about the cemetery. Getting information about the plot has been a challenge. The records for the cemetery were in the Lundeen Mortuary in Fort Lupton, but it burned down years ago, and all records burnt with it, he said. They buried most of the people. Knox also called the Archdiocese Catholic Church in Denver to see if they had a record of the cemetery, but representatives there said it didn't belong to them. Dr. Holly Catherine Norton, director of the Office of Archaeology and Historic Preservation, state archaeologist and deputy state historic preservation officer at History Colorado, said they did not have a record of the cemetery in their database, nor was it listed on the popular sites such as GraveFinder. She lives nearby and plans to visit it and see what she can learn. This cemetery is only 30 minutes from my house, so I'll make a point to get out there and record it, as well as see if we can locate any additional information on it and contact Mr. Knox, Dr. Norton said. Patricia Carmody with the Colorado Historic Cemetery Association, which provides resources to preserve and protect historic Colorado cemeteries, said Mr. Knox must map and record the graveyard before touching and cleaning it. On our site, we list several resources and books on how to preserve cemeteries, said Carmody. Jane Withers, Denver's famed Hubcap Annie, dies in Littleton. Friend remembers conversations with former businesswoman at nursing home. Hubcap Annie was once a fixture on Denver's East Colfax Avenue. It was the alter ego of Jane Withers, known for donning a Viking-style costume, a headdress, horns, and long gold braids. Who would wear that costume if they didn't have a sense of humor? I think that's what I liked about her, said Chris Styler, a volunteer at the Littleton Nursing Home where Withers lived her final days. Withers, in her 80s, died on April 25th, leaving behind a lively story and a legacy of local fame and redemption. She's different from anyone I've ever met. She's always had a story to tell, but she was always concerned about others, Steller said, describing her as crazy, feisty, wild, but definitely a caring person. Born in Cleveland and raised in Florida, Withers headed to Denver after getting permission to open a Hubcap Annie store as a franchise, Steller said. The business sold used hubcaps for cars back when many cars were equipped with the covers for wheels. Her store arrived in the Mile High City in the early 1980s, where she operated the business until 2008, becoming well known along the way. She boasted degrees in psychology and nursing from the University of Florida and worked as a registered nurse, but wanted to start a different life, I believe, Steller said. Her move west saw her grow enamored with hubcaps. Steller, who met Withers 9 years ago, once said to her, "If I asked you what the hubcap looked like for a 1964 Plymouth, would you be able to tell me?" And she was able to, Steller said. Her business took a seedy turn dealing in stolen hubcaps, Steller said. That included getting them off of cars in the parking lot of Mile High Stadium during Broncos games, Withers was quoted as saying in Car and Driver magazine. After police raided her store in a sting operation, she was charged with a felony and convicted, the magazine wrote. But she pushed on, and she began using her experiences to inspire others, becoming a motivational speaker and making it a point to hire employees who needed mentoring and a second chance, according to the Leader magazine from LifeCare, the nursing home company that housed her in recent years. "I think she always wanted to redeem herself, in a sense," Steller said. "She sure made up her mind that she was going to be a benefit and help other people." She was one of the founders of the Colorado Women's Chamber of Commerce, and photos show her with former officials, U.S. Senators, Denver Mayor Federico Peña, and Colorado Governors, Steller said. Even when she would slip into confusion amid dementia in her later years, she would still think she was going to give a lecture that evening, even up to last week, Steller said the day after she passed. "I just thought that was interesting that that was in the forefront of her mind," Steller added. At the Life Care Center of Littleton, where she lived and had many friends, Withers will be missed. Steller, a 72-year-old former real estate agent, remembers Withers' irreverent comments and what people around her called Jainisms, Steller said. "She's one of a kind," Steller said, "and I'll miss her sense of humor and her stories and just spending time with her." Highlands Ranch residents say safety is a big concern amid intersection reconstruction. Construction on South University Boulevard to be completed by the end of the summer. With over 1,000 concerned residents attending in person or online, Douglas County held a town hall Thursday night to address concerns about the reconstruction on a major intersection on South University Boulevard. Aimed to improve traffic flow, better accommodate bicyclists, and increase safety and mobility, the $13 million project began in August 2023. It is at the junction of South University Boulevard, Lincoln Avenue, and Quebec Street. In early April, the county made the decision to compress the schedule for the project, looking to complete it in late summer, before school starts, instead of in the fall. To do that, lanes were reduced down to one in each direction and, as construction progresses, additional lanes will open. But that has created some frustration for many drivers who came to the town hall at Southridge Recreation Center in Highlands Ranch or participated online to voice their concerns. "The biggest concern of the night is the large stream of cars that are cutting through nearby neighborhoods to avoid construction delays, many of them speeding," Another concern was the safety of drivers going through the intersection during construction. An average of 32,000 cars go through the intersection each day, and there have been 11 vehicle crashes in the area since the beginning of the year, said Douglas County Sheriff's Office Captain Dan McMillan. The Sheriff's Office has set up speed trailers that produce data such as peak traffic times, but residents wondered what the Sheriff's Office is doing with that data. County Traffic Division Manager Zeke Lynch said access signs were placed in neighborhoods to decrease the amount of traffic cutting through, and speed signs were put up to give people an indication of how fast they were going. However, the problem persists. Residents ask for interventions like temporary rubber stops or speed bumps, saying current safety efforts are not working, some pointing to a lack of consequences. I understand you can't stop them from coming through and the volume, I get that, a member of the public said, but the speed has got to be addressed. Lynch is also balancing the time it takes drivers to get through the intersection during construction. The traffic lights are on a 3-minute cycle, which is quite a bit longer, said Lynch. The idea behind doing that is to reduce the amount of lost time. Another factor is work time, which was expanded. Work starts at 7 a.m. and crews are given until 7 p.m. or 9 p.m. when necessary. Contractor Villalobos Concrete, Inc. originally worked from 8:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. as the county's commissioners thought it would be beneficial for drivers. But since we got started and heard the complaints and lived through it, frankly, we decided we just needed to rip that Band-Aid off and get this project done, said County Commissioner Laura Thomas. The engineering of it all. As Highlands Ranch began building in the early 1980s, engineering for roads was different. Steel and rebar were not used, as they are now. What we're seeing in Highlands Ranch is, we're just now reaching the point where roads need to be rebuilt, Dan Roberts, Assistant Director of Public Works Operations, said. By the end of the project, there will be updated traffic signals and raised pedestrian safety islands, an additional westbound lane on Lincoln Avenue and University Boulevard, an additional eastbound lane on University Boulevard and Lincoln Avenue, and an additional right-turn-only lane on South Quebec Street to westbound University Avenue. While some residents mentioned there has been construction in and around this intersection before, Roberts said they have made patches in the past and have been working on the current project for about 3 years. The goal is to build an intersection that will last 40 or 50 years, Roberts added. The contractor is using reinforced concrete that the new pavement is about 50% thicker than the original. The county has been authorized to use a certain concrete for the middle of the intersection so that it can be driven on the next day. Roberts said drivers can expect the traffic movements to change almost daily. Generally, what's going to happen is he'll, the contractor, do like one lane, like a checkerboard of one lane, said Roberts. The county encourages people to sign up for the text updates by texting QLU News to 21000. A text message will be sent every time there is a change. People can also visit https://rb.gy/d81020 to stay up to date. When questioned about their strategy, Roberts said they looked at several different alternatives, including working at night, but there were safety and noise concerns. The entire intersection couldn't be closed down all at once, as it's important to keep some of it open to allow for emergency vehicles to pass through, said Roberts. He also explained that working on each side of the intersection once at a time would have taken years and cost more due to construction inflation. It's better to just get it done, go through the difficult period, and then have the improvement afterwards, said County Commissioner George Teal. With most of southbound Quebec to be open in the next couple of weeks, the majority of the main pavement will be in place by July 4th. We just ask for your patience as we wrap this project up, said Lynch. Thank you for joining us for the Arapahoe County News. My name is Tim Elliott.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.